Corinth, good morning to you.
Morning, Your Honor.
Just a couple minutes. See you.
Your Honor, my name is Jim Corth. I'm from Ogallala. I represent the appellant and plaintiff in this case, Amy Rutledge. On August 3rd, 2012, the defendant, David Ford, attacked Ms. Rutledge, strangling her. Mr. Ford was employed by the defendant and appellee in this case, the City of Kimball. He was on duty at the time. The attack occurred at the City Building, which is owned was owned, operated, and maintained by the City of Kimball. The plaintiff and appellant has alleged the City of Kimball knew or should have known of a prior incident where Ford acted violently against another member of the public, and this action was brought against the City of Kimball under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, and the appellant alleged that the City of Kimball was negligent in failing to take proper measures to supervise Mr. Ford and to protect the general public, and specifically Ms. Rutledge from Ford, when the City of Kimball knew or should have known of Mr. Ford's past violent behavior and violent propensities and prior assaults. At issue in this case is Nebraska Revised Statute 13910, which includes the exemptions under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, specifically 13910 sub 7, which provides that excluded under the Act are any claims arising out of an assault, battery, etc.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
You have no quarrel with the idea that the attack by Mr. Ford was a battery?
It certainly was a battery, Your Honor. Agreed. In fact, in the trial court in this case, quite a while ago, dismissed the plaintiff's and the appellant's claim against the City of Kimball on a motion to dismiss. That's as far as we got. It relied upon the decision of this court in Britain versus the City of Crawford and its interpretation of 13910 sub 7, and specifically what I'll also acknowledge is relatively broad language arising out of a battery.
Would we have to overturn that case if we sided with you?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that this case is factually distinguishable from that case, and frankly, most of the cases that both parties cited in this case, in that the Britain case in Britain versus the City of Crawford did not have a tortfeasor with a prior bad act. It also did not occur on the premises owned and operated and maintained by the political subdivision, which was something we had present in this case. And so our contention is that Britain isn't controlling in this case.
What theory of liability did you plead? Was it premises liability? Was it respondeat superior? Was it failure to supervise? What's the theory, the tort theory in the complaint?
It certainly was failure to supervise, but I think it also goes to basically premises liability as well, Your Honor.
What would you direct us to in the operative complaint that suggests you pled a premises liability theory?
Just the general language that the City of Kimball failed to supervise Ford and to protect the general public, including, or specifically, Rutledge.
And how does that relate to premises?
It doesn't specifically refer to premises liability, Your Honor. I would acknowledge that.
Okay. Before you go back in, ultimately you dismissed the claim against Ford with prejudice.
We settled our claim against Mr. Ford.
Does that dismissal make any difference to our analysis?
I don't believe so. My understanding of final orders was we weren't in a position to appeal this decision until we were done with Mr. Ford. And so, had we been able to appeal it, we would have appealed it then so that we could have proceeded against everybody at the same time.
Now, the dismissal didn't recite any settlement, did it? It just said we dismissed.
That's correct.
With prejudice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does that make any difference?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
It's not certainly not something that, either party addressed or argued in their briefs, so it's not really something I looked at, but I don't,
okay.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
The cases that we cited and argued in our brief that we believe are controlling include the case of Sheridan versus the United States. And in that case, the Supreme Court of the United States noted that while the general rule is that intentional torts by an employee of a political subdivision or governmental entity are excluded, exception would lie where there exists an independent legal duty. And in that case, I believe that the independent legal duty arose from a couple of things. One was the state involved had a Good Samaritan law. And also, I think the naval base that was involved had...
What is the independent legal duty here?
It would be the... I was going to talk about the second case, Your Honor, which is the Doe versus the Omaha Public School District, which talked about an independent legal duty in that case arising from premises liability, a landlord invitee, duty to take reasonable steps to protect against foreseeable acts of violence. And, you know, and that premises liability obligation or duty is certainly recognized in Doe. It's also recognized in other cases involving a landowner who has knowledge of prior acts of violence on the premises sufficient to create foreseeability for the landowner. And in this case, our belief is that this law would the operative law here would apply the same if Ford hadn't been an employee of the city of Kimball. If he had simply been or any individual had committed a violent act previously, say in the parking lot of this city building, city had knowledge of the prior bad act or more than one. We never got that far. We never got to conduct discovery. We don't know how many times this happened, but if that was foreseeable to the city that there might be additional future acts of violence on the city premises, then under this line of cases, the future act of violence would be foreseeable to the city, and it would have to take reasonable steps to prevent, again, future acts of violence. So the fact...
Do you concede here that without the battery, there would be... you would have no cause of action?
Yeah, and that was what the trial court concluded, and I think it's a kind of a... I felt when I read it that it was kind of a circular argument. I mean, certainly, battery occurs. What causes of action do you have against the tortfeasor, against, in this case, the political subdivision? But if the political subdivision hadn't been negligent, our contention is there wouldn't have been a battery. So, but certainly, the causes of action, there never would have been a lawsuit if against anybody if my client hadn't been assaulted.
How do we deal with the concept that under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, it has to be strictly construed that the legislature had to very clearly say that subdivisions should be or could be held liable in these kinds of situations?
And I understand that's the standard that this court has to employ. I do believe there have been a number of prior decisions where the language is construed and different decisions are reached depending on the specific facts of the case. And again, I point to U.S. Scheer versus the United States and Sheridan versus the United States in that case. In Scheer, the general rule was, at least for the Federal Tort Claims Act, was established. In Sheridan, they're interpreting the statute and they're essentially creating a exception, if you will, for instances where there's an independent legal duty that's owed.
The U.S. Supreme Court, in interpreting the Federal Tort Claims Act, does not use the same strict scrutiny that we do for the Nebraska Tort Claims Act. Doesn't that make a difference when one looks at their decisions and tries to import that into our jurisprudence?
It potentially it might, Your Honor. I just know that this court in, I think it was State versus Johnson, did look at and incorporate both the reasoning in Scheer and in Sheridan. So I think this court has, in construing the statute in question, has looked at each case on a case-by-case basis and has, I won't say carved out exceptions, but has made decisions on that basis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank
you, Your Honor. If we accept your argument, would we be carving out an exception?
I think that this case, I don't know that I would call it a case of first impression, but again, I don't, any of the cases that were cited by myself or by the appellee, I don't believe there has been a case in Nebraska where you had a tortfeasor who was alleged to have committed prior acts of violence, and the acts of violence occurred on the premises in question. So I don't know that it's an exception to the rule. I think it's just applying prior case law, prior precedent of the United States Supreme Court and this court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Olson, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Steve Olson. I represent the City of Kimball. To rule in favor of the appellant would actually do just that, Your Honor, and that is to carve out an exception and, in fact, to make the intentional tort exception useless. That's what we have seen in a number of cases, is litigants trying to plead around that exception, trying to take different words, whether it be failure to properly hire somebody or the failure to supervise them, failure to protect. They've all used different language, and yet many courts, including this court, has always said that exception was written by our legislature broadly.
Well, that was it. Have we always said that? I think your opposing counsel is arguing that the Doe case carved out an exception for premises liability. What would be your response to that?
And we disagree. First of all, the Doe case had nothing to do with an employment relationship. The assailant was not employed by the Omaha Public Schools. So there was no situation in terms of the actions of an employee that 13.9.10 governs in terms of that intentional tort exception. If you look at all the different exceptions under 19.10, they all deal with that political subdivision, and they all deal with an employee who is not only employed but also in the course of his employment. Doe doesn't give us that. So it was very easy for the court in that case to find that there was some other claim completely independent of that employment relationship, and that was to provide some security and protection to students. And that's the only case. If we look at Johnson, if we look at Britton, if we look at DM, all those cases say that when you have an employee and you have somebody who's working in the course of his employment, then that exception of arising out of an assault and battery is broad enough to cover whatever negligence is included in those different claims.
Could a plaintiff rely on a premises liability theory even if the assailant happens to be an employee? Why couldn't they plead premises liability with the assailant happening to be an employee?
They could. That wasn't done in this case. And there is no claim in this case of premises liability. You've got two different claims: that we failed to supervise, a negligence claim, and the second one was we failed to protect, both sounding in negligence. And in fact, both of those have been found in other cases. The Scheer case was a failure to protect. And despite that, the Supreme Court found that exception applied. Johnson was a failure to supervise case. And in that case,
how does failure to protect relate to premises liability?
We don't think it does. We don't think that it does at all. It's a separate, it's simply based and couched in negligence, and this court has found in other cases, including the Johnson case, that failure doesn't take out responsibility, that intentional tort exception still applies. So we believe that this is simply negligence, and they haven't established anything that is independent from that negligence that would constitute a claim that would take us out of that intentional tort exception.
We side with you. Do we have to distinguish Doe or overrule Doe? Or
no. Don't have to overrule Doe. I think Doe is his own separate facts that really have no relevance to this case because there is no employment relationship on the part of that assailant to the Omaha Public Schools. Omaha Public Schools had a completely different duty that may have been owed, arguably, to the family and to the victim. And that would have been based upon knowledge that somebody had some propensity to do this, and that there was some then duty to provide security and protection to that young student. We don't have that here. So to rule in our favor would be to affirm what this court has done in the Johnson case, in the Britton case, in the DM case. That would provide consistency, and it would also leave us with a situation where that exception means what it means. To everything that the appellant in this case has alleged arises out of a battery. She has no claims but for that battery. So too, everything in this case arises out of the employment of Mr. Ford with the City of Kimball. But for his employment, the battery wouldn't have occurred. And but for his employment, any history of other violent acts, if they happened, would not have occurred. So you cannot separate any other claims that the appellant tries to make in this case to the actions of Mr. Ford that have been admitted by the appellant were in the course of his employment.
I understand your argument that we don't have to overrule Doe to rule in your favor, but should we consider overruling Doe to the extent it fails to strictly construe waivers of sovereign immunity?
Absolutely. To the extent that it is still cited and relied upon in these kinds of cases, then I think the court certainly needs to make that known, because it really stands out by itself. The other case that goes along with Doe many times is the Sheridan case. And at least the Sheridan case dealt with some issues in terms of the employment relationship, even though the assailant was not on duty at the time and not on the military base at the time. So even though there are arguments about the effect of that, still it is so far different than Doe. We just don't believe that Doe is a proper case to be used by anybody in terms of these types of cases and the intentional tort exception under 13.9.10.7. The biggest issue is each case, again, if you follow the appellant, what that allows litigants to do is try to plead around this exception. And whatever terminology they want to use, that's what's happened. And that does away with the effectiveness of that exception, and that's not what the legislature intended.
Is the suggestion then that the tension between being an employee and premises liability, that being an employee, the fact of being an employee will trump the premises liability jurisprudence?
Yes. And I think all the way back to Scheer and even before Scheer, though, that was one of the key things, that as long as you have an employee, and long as that employee is in the scope of his employment, then any negligence that you can find conceivably could fit within the negligence that would be covered under arising out of an assault or battery. That was the result in Scheer. That was the discussion in Sheridan that may have happened but for the fact that the assailant was not on duty at the time.
But he was an employee.
He was, but not at the time. So the analysis there was him shooting into a car. What did that have to do at all with his employment? And it did not. Here, you've got a situation, just as you did in Britton, just as you did in Johnson, just as you did in DM, where you cannot separate the employment from any other actions. Every action in this case by Mr. Ford was while he was employed.
And on duty?
And on duty. And the appellant has admitted those facts. Now, the interesting thing when you get to a case like Britton, the plaintiff there tried to reframe their complaint, so it had nothing to do with the employment relationship. Nothing about improper hiring, nothing about improper supervision, nothing about protecting anybody. In fact, they went instead and looked at the techniques that were used by law enforcement to de-escalate a situation, and the techniques that were used by law enforcement to address somebody who was a barricaded suspect.
But was it critical in Britton that there was no allegation of intention, right? Intention to shoot the victim.
I think in that case they talked about whether it be intentional or whether it be negligence. It would fall still within that exception.
Okay.
But I think the key is that even though we didn't have all those claims about premises liability or other negligence, we had claims that dealt with, are you using the proper police techniques or not? The court still found that that was negligence sufficient to fit within that broad intentional torts exception. And I think in the Westcott case out of the Eighth Circuit, the same thing. There were not employment-related claims. Instead, there were claims that you took a flashing light for a gun going off. So again, nothing dealing with employment, but yet the court still said that those were actions that you cannot separate from the employment of the defendant and the assailant in shooting his gun. And we feel here that it would be unreasonable to say that somehow you can separate Ford from what he did in terms of that battery with something else that happened while he was in the course of his employment and somehow related to the appellant. We just don't believe that that comes within the exception.
Is Ford's dismissal from this lawsuit with prejudice significant to our analysis?
We believe it is. That was a dismissal with prejudice. Did not reserve the claims to come after the city of Kimball. So we believe that resolves the cases as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No.
We do not have any time for rebuttal. So we will go on to the next case of the day, which is, this is Employers Mutual Casualty Company.